This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think the big story about climate in the last 10 years is how lucky we've been with the technological development.
One of the things I love about this job is that I get to have conversations with people who know a lot more than I do. This week on Sea Change Radio, I chat with Daniel Kirk Davidoff, a climate scientist at MDA Information Systems and an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland. First, he tells me about how the science of predicting changes in climate and weather influences how utility companies and future markets behave. Then we talk about the challenges the developing world faces to keep carbon emissions low, even as populations expand. Last, he talks about how different the electric grid of tomorrow may look in a few decades. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Kirk Davidoff. He's the chief scientist for weather and climate at MDA Information Systems. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland. Dan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex. This is great.
Why don't you first give us a quick overview of what MDA Information Systems is about?
Sure. We're a company that provides weather forecast services, among other things, to energy and agricultural interests. So if you're interested in buying and selling electricity in tomorrow's market, you might want to know whether it's going to be hot or cold. And if it's in summertime, if it's hotter, we'll probably be using more electricity. So you'd want to know that before guessing what the price of electricity is going to be tomorrow. And then similarly, if you're someone who buys and sells agricultural products, or if you're a farmer, you might want to know what we're expecting for crop yields in some part of the world. So if you wanted to know, you know, what the best science would suggest the soybean yield in Iowa will be this summer, we'll give our best shot at that.
So who accesses your information?
Sure. These are people who buy and sell electricity is a big chunk of our clients.
I see.
And there's a lot of those folks. So they're most electrical utilities these days, in addition to providing electricity for their own clients directly, they may have a little bit extra at the end of the day, but they might think that they're going to have a little more capacity tomorrow than there will be demand in their market. And then they can go up to the grid operators like California ISO or the Midwest ISO, that stands for Independent System Operator. And they might go on to a market that those folks run and say, we'd be willing to sell some extra electricity on the market tomorrow at 3 o'clock for 4 cents a kilowatt hour or 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And depending on what the price of the market turns out to be, they run a little automatic auction. And if the price turns out to be lower than what you said you'd sell it for, then you won't get to sell. But if it turns out to be a little higher than what you said you'd sell it for, then you will get to sell and you'll make some money.
And what kind of time frame do you usually work in? 6-9 month kind of cycles or longer?
Oh, no. So those folks who are doing electricity buying and selling, they want to know about the weather tomorrow because they're going to go into some kind of auction at 3 o'clock. It's called the day ahead market. And they're going to go into an auction, say, at 3 o'clock and at 4 o'clock and at 5 o'clock today to sell power for 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, or 5 o'clock tomorrow. So they just want to know as precisely as possible what the weather is going to be like tomorrow.
So you've been a climate scientist for almost 20 years. You've probably seen quite a bit of movement just in these last two decades. Is it possible to kind of extrapolate the next two decades and give us a picture without scaring us too much of what you see?
Sure. The number that a lot of people look at would be global average temperature. And if we just looked at that, we'd say, oh, well, this isn't going to matter very much for electricity markets because you'd look at the global average temperature and you'd see that we've gone up by about 1 degree Celsius over average over the world in about a century. So we're expecting that pace is going to pick up. And in fact, it has picked up. We've increased more rapidly over the last few decades than we did over the first couple of decades. So we might expect another 2 or so degrees over the next, say, 80 years. And that's Celsius. So in Fahrenheit, that would be like, if you 2 degrees Celsius, that'd be like 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a little bit, you know, if it's 90 degrees this summer, but we're expecting that the same kind of conditions that gave us 90 degree weather this summer would bring us like 94 degree weather by the end of the century. Well, that's, you know, it takes more energy on a warmer day to keep us comfortable. Now, that's a global average number. The numbers over the continents and where people live have generally been higher. So averaged over the United States, you might maybe double the expectation for how much warmer it's going to get over that time. So then you're talking over a century or, you know, over 80 years, maybe something like, what are we up to, like 5-6 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe even a little more. And that's, you know, that's getting to be pretty appreciable. But if you're talking about like just next summer, then probably the best way to estimate that is just to look at how the trends have been for the last 20 years. You know, take the long-term average and then see how that temperature has changed. So take the average, take the trend, and then, you know, extrapolate the trend by one more year. So any one year is not going to be hugely different from the year before that. It's just that, you know, we live a long time and we worry about what the planet's going to be like for our kids and grandkids and so on. So, you know, even though the change is pretty gradual from one year to the next, that still means that by the end of a century, if the change keeps going in the same direction, it gets to be pretty appreciable and something we ought to be concerned about and doing something about.
Paint us a picture, if you will, of what things might look like in, let's say, 2040.
Sure. So there's a couple of things going on, right? Where we'll have a little, we'll have some more global warming over that time, right? Over the last, you know, the world's warmed up by, oh, let's see, over the last 50 years, it's been about, you know, about a degree Fahrenheit or so, and it's been getting a little bit faster. So we might expect about, you know, maybe 2 degrees over that time or a degree and a half. And on the other hand, we are trying to introduce policy so that that doesn't go on forever and that we come to some kind of equilibrium at a temperature for the globe that doesn't cause us a lot of problems. And so we're introducing measures to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we emit that's going to tend to warm the planet. And so the big changes in the grid have to do with, you know, not some expectation that we'll need a lot more electricity to keep us comfortable, but because in fact our electricity demand hasn't been going up very much in the Western world. We've kind of done all the things that people want to do with electricity. We keep our houses pretty cool in the summer and pretty warm in the winter, and our houses are about as big as anyone needs, and our population isn't growing too fast, and even though it is growing, our efficiency is getting better. So we're able to, you know, provide the same amount of heat and light with less energy, right? That's what the transition to light-emitting diodes from incandescent bulbs was about. So most people aren't expecting a very large increase in how much electricity we need to make over the next few years. It's just that we want to be doing it in a way that doesn't burden the environment so much. So what everyone's expecting and hoping is that we'll be generating a lot higher fraction of our electricity in 25 years from non-fossil resources than we are now.
And that's just talking about the developed world. Do you think that the developing world will be able to come in line by that time in terms of being able to deliver base load energy to their increasing populations while not catching up to the developed world in terms of its fossil fuel emissions? That seems to be one of the real concerns, is how do we tell these people that have had 100 years of not having the same kind of energy systems that we've had, now all of a sudden the party's over? That seems to be a real boulder in the road, doesn't it?
No. I think people worried about that a while ago, but I don't think it's turning out that way. What we're seeing, actually, first of all, no one's going to tell India and China to reduce their carbon emissions. India and China are interested in reducing their carbon emissions because they don't want a miserable world for their people, you know, 20 and 40 and 50 and 60 and 80 years from now.
I was thinking more about Africa. Sorry to interrupt, but I was thinking more about sub-Saharan Africa and countries that don't have real national energy policy in place even yet.
Well, actually, sub-Saharan African countries have a huge amount of energy policy going on. They're thinking about it quite a lot. Actually, I spent one of my projects at MDA was writing a modernization plan for the Uganda Weather Service. And people all over sub-Saharan Africa are thinking very hard about climate change. After all, they're in one of the warmer parts of the world, and so getting warmer is generally not a great thing for them. And they have a general sense that, you know, climate is changing and precipitation patterns are changing. And since a lot of folks there are engaged in subsistence agriculture, that kind of stuff is very concerning for them. Now, you know, the documentation on that stuff is a little sparse because the system isn't, weather and climate aren't observed quite as well as, you know, they would hope. And they're working on that. And actually, the UN is working pretty hard to subsidize improvements in observing systems all over Africa. But the larger issue that you bring up, like, is, you know, is Africa going to be prevented from developing because of, you know, climate policy, is I've always thought that's a pretty ludicrous concern. I mean, Africa's contribution to CO2 emissions is quite small, probably the largest or you know, close to equal to the contribution to CO2 that they make towards warming is from agricultural burning.
And that's similar to what's happening in places in like South America as well, right? That's Sweden agriculture.
You're right. Mechanized agriculture in Brazil has resulted in a fair amount of deforestation. But on the other hand, it's been extremely successful. I mean, when I was in college, my recollection is that people were saying, oh, this is a terrible idea, cutting down rainforest to grow soybeans, because you're only going to be able to do it, you know, once, and then you're going to exhaust all the nutrients in the soil, which is pretty poor quality, and it won't even be good for agriculture. But actually, Brazil's been pretty smart in figuring out how to maintain industrialized agriculture in those parts of the world. We're getting a little bit outside of my area of expertise, so I don't want to. I'll stop there without blabbing too much. But the point is, Brazil grows a heck of a lot of soybeans, and mechanized agriculture, when it arrives. As it arrives in sub-Saharan Africa, is going to be a big part of what, you know, enables people to live more prosperous lives. And its impact on climate is probably going to be a bit ambiguous, because on the one hand, you probably won't be doing as much of slash and burn agriculture, and there probably won't be as much burning involved. But on the other hand, it takes fuels to run the mechanized agriculture. But the larger point I was heading towards was that Africa's contribution to global warming now is vanishingly small compared to the rest of the world. And, you know, their getting richer is not going to make it worse, because they're not getting richer at a very rapid pace. And by the time they do, renewables are likely to be very cheap indeed. In fact, already, if you travel around Africa, you see lots and lots of people installing solar power on roofs in little remote villages that don't have electricity wires strung up to reach them. So, you know, folks who want to have a cell phone or, you know, want to have light at night will put solar collectors up and charge phones that way. And some people make a little business charging cell phones and that kind of thing. And there's also lots of utility scale renewables going on in Africa. So one of a very nice region for wind generation is this area around Lake Turkana in Kenya. And there's hundreds of megawatts of wind turbines going up there. And there's large industrial scale solar generation facilities going up all over Africa.
Because the wind is high, it blows my mind.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kirk Davidoff. Dan's a scientist at MDA Information Systems. So you don't see the African issue as being an important piece in the puzzle in terms of overall emissions. It's not going to really impact things the way the chief emitters will, like China, India, and the U.S. Is that fair to say?
I think it's not a big stumbling block. It's not that, Africa is going to have the same challenges that all of us have moving to a very low fossil fuel electrical grid, but I don't think it presents special challenges, and I don't think it presents big challenges of justice, because it might if we lived in a world where the only way to generate low fossil fuel energy was some expensive practice, but it's been a contingent and wonderful development of the last 10 years that policy designed to make renewables cheaper has succeeded immensely, has succeeded beyond most people's wildest dreams of 10 or even 10 or 15 years ago, right? So, we are at a point now in terms of cost for both wind and solar that's much, much lower than people expected to be at by 2020 or 2025, if you'd asked folks back in like 1995 where we'd be. So, back in 95, you could say, electrical power is going to be expensive and we rich countries can manage that. Low carbon electricity will be expensive and we rich companies can manage that. But surely we can't make Africa go down some very expensive sort of luxury path towards electrification. And that's just not really going to be an issue because the renewables have gotten so much cheaper.
Fair enough. So let's look into the future then and just stick to the country most of our listeners know best, the United States. Where will an average American citizen who lives in Silver Springs, Maryland, or Tuscaloosa, Alabama, be getting their power when they turn on the lights when they get home?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So it depends on a lot of things. First of all, it depends on policy. I'm speaking as though it's a foregone conclusion that we're going to maintain climate policy and, keep trying to ratchet down CO2 emissions over the last 25 years, but that might not happen. If that didn't happen, the answer would be that probably we're going to get a lot of our power from gas, from natural gas, because that's become quite cheap in the last few years. And, while solar and wind have gotten very cheap and in some places comparable even to the very low prices that the natural gas is at, they're still a bit more expensive, averaged over the country and in general. So, minus any kind of climate policy, I think we'd build a lot of gas turbines and we'd generate our electricity that way. But assuming that we do have climate policy, then still the answer is going to be a little bit different depending on where you are in the country. And that in itself, that the power might be different in different parts of the country, is also a little bit contingent on policy. So the power mix being different in different parts of the country depends on two things. It depends on what kind of power you can generate in different parts of the country. And then it also depends on how far away you can bring power to you, from how far away you can bring power to you. So if we decide to build a lot of long distance transmission capability, then it becomes cheaper to run the whole country off of a very high proportion of renewable energy, because you don't have to overbuild so much, because if the sun isn't shining in one part of the country, it probably is shining in another part of the country. And if it's all just one big electrical grid, then it doesn't matter where the sun's shining. As long as it's shining somewhere, you can generate electricity there, and likewise with wind. On the other hand, in our current situation, while we have some electrical connections connecting the whole country together, it's not really feasible to transport a huge amount of power from, say, one side of the country all the way to the other side. We don't, for example, transport a huge amount of power from, say, Iowa to Maryland. But Iowa has an unbelievably rich wind resource, and Maryland has a good wind resource offshore, but it's expensive to build wind offshore. So if we were trying to build the cheapest, greenest, renewable dominant electrical grid, we'd probably have a lot of long distance transmission, and we'd probably build a lot of wind in the middle part of the country where the wind's strongest. Now, I'm basing this on some work that some very good scientists out at University of Colorado, including a guy named Christopher Clack, have published recently that shows exactly how the cost of a highly renewable grid varies depending on how much of the country is all wired together.
Do you think that energy consumers will be more conscious of the weather and the time of day when they consume energy than they do now, where it's just kind of an all-you-can-eat buffet for the last 70-odd years in most of America?
Yeah, that's a neat question. So one of the things we haven't really gotten into is what are the obstacles to having a renewable heavy grid? And the main thing that people always point out correctly is that the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time. So obviously at night there's no solar power. Fortunately, nighttime is when the wind tends to be strongest at the height where the wind turbines are. But, you know, it's not windy every night. So what do you do about that problem? You know, there are a couple of ways that you handle the intermittency of renewable generation. And one of those is you do demand management. So you change the price and have systems either by price or by some other mechanism where people are encouraged to use less electricity during times when the renewables aren't around and demand is high, so you're having trouble getting to balance. But then the other possibility is that you have storage. And that's been another very, very important development over recent years, is that storage has gotten cheaper faster than people expected 10 or 15 years ago. So one of the exciting things about switching to electric transportation is that we'd have all these batteries hooked up to the grid charging cars overnight when, you know, demand is typically low and wind generation, for example, is typically high. And then, you know, if you plug those cars in after you drove them to work, or if, you know, some of those cars were just staying at home anyway during the course of the day, you could draw down those batteries at times when demand was high and, you know, renewable generation wasn't there. But never mind the car batteries, you can just build dedicated storage facilities. And there's a bunch of different ways of doing that. You know, you can pump water uphill and then generate electricity when it runs back down again. You know, you can chill water and use that, you know, overnight and use that to provide air conditioning during the course of the day, which is sort of a way of storing energy, right? And there's a bunch of different approaches like that. And those are, you know, how we hope that a very heavily renewable grid would work. But it may not even be necessary. One of the very nice findings that, this study that I referred to earlier by Christopher Clack, was that you can match demand hour by hour, you know, using real histories of demand from, you know, recent years with a very heavily renewable grid if you're just strategic about where you put your renewable generation. He was also assuming that we maintain our nuclear fleet. And I think that's a really important thing for people to understand, that having a big chunk, it's what, about 20% of our generation that comes from a zero carbon energy source, has a lot of value for averting climate change. And we want to think pretty hard about what our plan for the future is to either maintain that or replace it with some other equally low carbon source.
Just looking at the trends and what's the real source of the problem, it used to be transportation in the 70s and 80s. And then the last 10, 20 years, people started saying, you know what, cars are just one small piece of the puzzle. We really have to look at power plants and where that electricity is being generated. And the problem is that they're all carbon emitters at this point, and we have to kind of look at them in a holistic sense.
Absolutely. So each transportation and electricity generation are each a big chunk, you know, approximately equal chunk of the CO2 that the United States generates. And, you know, if we're going to get to a very low level of CO2 emissions, you know, we're hoping, the whole world is hoping to get down to something like a fifth of what we now generate by late in this century. And to do that, we're going to have a zero fossil fuel transportation system and a near zero fossil fuel electrical grid. And, you know, exactly how we do that is interesting. You know, if you'd asked people 15 years ago, I think you would have had even votes between a hydrogen powered transportation network where we're all driving cars powered with hydrogen and we generate the hydrogen using zero carbon energy, An electrical battery powered transportation grid. But, you know, progress in batteries has been faster than progress in hydrogen fuel tank, which has always been the trouble with hydrogen. You have to build big, heavy tanks to carry it around. So now I think, you know, most people who look at how we're going to make a very low carbon transportation network think it's probably going to involve a lot of batteries. But there's even if we can do that with cars, people generally think, I think that moving heavy stuff around, you know, trucking is going to require fossil fuels. We could electrify our rail network, but our truck network is a big part of what moves goods around, both in the U.S. and in Europe. And to do that in a zero carbon way, that gets interesting in the same way that trying to move people around by airplane gets interesting. And probably that involves some kind of either biofuel or some kind of synthetic fuel process where we're using energy derived from clean sources to generate carbon fuels, maybe by sucking CO2 out of the air and reformulating that into fuels. And that way you could have a closed cycle that allowed us to have this energy intensive fuel that we can use to move big, heavy objects around, but not emit net carbon dioxide.
So in your almost two decades of being a climate scientist, Dan, what gives you hope for the future? Where has the biggest progress come from?
I think the big story about climate in the last 10 years is how lucky we've been with the technological development. You know, that energy policy designed to subsidize the development of low fossil fuel sources has been hugely successful. You know, we've managed to bring down the price of solar and wind power and energy and electrical storage very quickly to levels where we're, you know, within shouting distance of getting to a point where you don't need a very large subsidy anymore because they're almost as cheap, or and in some cases they really are cheaper than fossil fuel sources for generating electricity. So that's great. It's wonderful. And it should be very encouraging to all of us that if we can maintain, you know, a rational climate policy that says that maintaining the Earth's climate at the level that we evolved to flourish in it is going to be manageable if we can, you know, keep our eyes on the prize and keep working on it.
Daniel Kirk Davidoff is a chief scientist for weather and climate at MDA Information Systems, and he's also an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland. Dan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lettuce and the Beatles. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.